Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Doctrine of Christ, Part 22. For more resources, including articles, books, podcasts, audio, and video, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Let's go to our lesson now, which is on the best explanation for the facts surrounding the fate of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll remember I said that a case for Jesus' resurrection historically has two elements or steps to it. First, establishing the basic facts to be explained, and then secondly, asking what is the best explanation of those facts. And we saw that with respect to the facts to be explained, there is in large measure something of a consensus among New Testament scholars today, namely, number one, that Jesus was buried in a tomb by a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin named Joseph of Arimathea. Two, that tomb was then found empty on the first day of the week following the crucifixion by a group of Jesus' women followers. Thirdly, that thereafter various individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And finally, number four, that the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite having every predisposition to the contrary. Now, the question is, what is the best explanation of those facts? Well, the disciples gave one. We can call it R for the resurrection hypothesis, and that is that God raised Jesus from the dead. And the question is that the best explanation of what happened? Now, it's very interesting when you look at the work of skeptics about Jesus' resurrection, their reservations with the resurrection hypothesis are not historical reservations. They're philosophical reservations. This explanation is rejected not on its historical merits or demerits, but rather because of philosophical objections to it. For example, Bart Ehrman, whom we've discussed before, agrees with all four of those facts that I've mentioned, but he says the historian cannot adopt the resurrection hypothesis as the best explanation. And he says that even if the resurrection actually happened. He's not saying the resurrection didn't occur. Maybe the resurrection really did happen. Nevertheless, he would say the historian cannot infer that that is the best explanation of the facts. Why not? Well, his reason is philosophical. He says a miracle, by definition, is the most improbable thing that could happen, and therefore no amount of historical evidence could ever go to establish a miraculous explanation, like God raised Jesus from the dead. In fact, he says, to think that historical evidence could establish this is to utter a self-contradiction. It's to say that the most improbable event is the most probable. And that's simply contradictory, to say the most probable event is the least probable event. Now, if you know your history of philosophy, you'll recognize that this objection by Bart Ehrman is nothing new. This is the objection that was presented by the Scottish skeptic David Hume in the 1700s in his essay of Miracles. And Ehrman unknowingly simply presents a kind of warmed-over version of David Hume's argument against the identification of a miracle. According to Hume, all the evidence of of mankind's experience has established the laws of nature, that the laws of nature are true, including that dead men don't rise from the dead. And he said, therefore, no amount of testimony to an event which is a violation of nature's laws could ever be the best explanation of the evidence. It will simply be overwhelmed or at least counterbalanced by all of the evidence for the laws of nature allegedly violated by the miracle. And therefore, you could never be justified in inferring that the best explanation of the facts is that God raised Jesus from the dead, because that is so, so extraordinarily improbable. Now, this Humean objection has entered into popular culture. I bet every one of you has heard the following claim. Extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence. Extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence. And the implication is that the evidence for the resurrection is not strong enough to establish that hypothesis. This is basically a reprise of David Hume's objection. Extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence, and therefore you could never have enough evidence to establish so extraordinary an event as the resurrection of Jesus. This is just a popular slogan that encapsulates David Hume's argument. Now, a somewhat different objection that I want to raise now, we'll look at both of them in a moment, but I want to get both the objections on the table. Oddly enough, and perhaps unexpectedly, comes from Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga has not been very sympathetic to historical apologetics. He prefers that belief in Christian claims like the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus be rooted in the testimony of the Holy Spirit rather than in historical evidence. When you read the scripture, the Holy Spirit bears witness to you that this is true so that you can justifiably believe in it. But he's skeptical about the value of historical apologetics for events like this. Why is this? Well, he says that the historical apologist faces what he calls the problem of dwindling probabilities. The problem of dwindling probabilities. Now, what is that? Basically, what he's saying is that in order to establish something like the resurrection of Jesus, you first got to establish a number of other claims to show that those are probable. For example, suppose you want to establish that God raised Jesus from the dead. Well, first you're going to need to establish that God exists, and that will have a certain probability. Let's say, to be generous, let's suppose that it's 90% certain that God exists, so we'll call that 0.9. But then in addition to that, you'll need to establish, say, that Jesus of Nazareth ever existed. And let's suppose once again that the probability that Jesus existed is 0.9. Well, the joint probability of both of those together will be 0.9 times 0.9 or 0.81, still pretty high. But then you'll also need to establish, say, that Jesus made certain radical claims about himself to be the Son of God. And maybe you can show that with 0.9 probability. And then you'll need to show things like the historicity of the empty tomb. And let's suppose you can show that the tomb was empty with 0.9 probability. And then maybe the resurrection appearances will need to be established. You can show that with 0.9 probability. Well, what happens, you see, as you multiply these, the probability of all of them just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. There's this dwindling probabilities. In fact, after just 7 steps of 0.9 probability, you're already going to be less than 50%, which makes it less probable than not that Jesus rose from the dead. And so he thinks that the problem of dwindling probabilities is a major obstacle for the attempt of certain people like Richard Swinburne in particular to establish the probability of the resurrection hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead. Now, before we look at each of these in some detail, let me ask, is there any comprehension type question about any of these? Any question about understanding? I'm not looking for your critical reaction here, but just a comprehension question. Yes, Brad.
I always wondered about this. The probability of anything that actually occurred, if you use prior probabilities and Bayesian logic to try and arrive at the probability of that occurring, it's almost always zero. You know, the probability of me being here today.
Yeah. Okay, now you're not raising a comprehension question here, Brad.
I'm wondering,
you're raising, I think, a very good objection. What Brad is saying is, we apply this kind of reasoning all the time. And if you did this, this would rule out ordinary events in history, scientific discoveries. There's got to be something wrong with the argument. It may not be obvious. I mean, and a guy like Plantinga is so brilliant, it's not going to be an evident mistake. But there's got to be a mistake here, because as Brad says, otherwise we would be skeptics about practically, well, so much. And that's surely unreasonable. So I think Brad is raising a very good point, and I'll comment more on that. Okay, Cindy.
It seems to me that he's assuming that the prior belief has to be, or each belief has to be solely determinant from the prior belief. Does that make sense? So therefore, yes, you do the math. But that's not necessarily the case. So you don't, it could be greater than that one event and strip away five of the 0.9s.
Uh-huh. Have you studied probability theory, Cindy?
No.
You sound as though you have.
It's
again,
just logic.
You're not raising comprehension questions, but this is the point that we'll see that Tim McGrew at the University of Western Michigan makes in response to planning is something very much along these lines. So you're thinking critically, which is good. But so let me ask, is there a comprehension type question, something you don't understand about the objections that Hume or planning has raised? Drew. Yeah, see, I know you don't. Okay, go ahead.
I'll try to make this an actual comprehension question. All right, so Ehrman and Hume, are they saying that our experience has shown us that the universe is like a closed system under physics, or that we have evidence of like supernatural claims being debunked, but no scientific evidence of supernatural claims being confirmed? Is that sort of their
opinion? Okay, this is a good question. Neither Hume nor Ehrman is saying that the universe is a closed system and that miracles don't occur. It's very important to understand that neither Hume nor Ehrman is arguing against the occurrence of a miracle. Rather, both of them are arguing against the possibility of the identification of a miracle. That if a miracle occurred, you would never be justified in inferring that a miracle had occurred, because it will always be more probable by the very nature of the case that the event is not miraculous, that there's some natural explanation. So in one sense, they would admit that this might lead you maybe to mistakenly miss a miracle. There might be a miracle that's actually occurred, but because of the nature of historical studies, you wouldn't be able to spot it. And so it's not an argument against the existence or the occurrence of miracles. It's against the possibility of identifying a miracle, and therefore, by implication, against anyone ever believing that God raised Jesus from the dead. Even if God did raise Jesus, you could never be justified in believing that.
It sounds like they're saying, then, that rarity of an event entails improbability.
Well, that does connection. Seem to be a problem, Drew. I think you're right. It seems they're working with a kind of frequency model of probability, or... Well, yes, because Hume says things like that. So that's a problem as well. Some other comprehension-type question? Yes, way in the back here, Don Pendley has a question.
The question is this, Bill. Why do they multiply the factors together to come up with an overall average? If you take a coin and flip it, there's a 50% chance it'll come up heads, 50% chance it'll come up tails. What's the probability of, on the next flip? It's exactly the same.
Yes, now...
So, if you did that 15 times in a row, it wouldn't influence the probability of the next flip of a coin.
Yes, what Don is describing is something called the gambler's fallacy. The gambler's fallacy is thinking that the next event is affected...
Can we rephrase that word? From gambler's fallacy to something else.
Well, why would it
sound bad just on the face of it?
Well, but I mean, that's good that you're exposing fallacious reasoning. The gambler's fallacy says, and this is so easy to fall into, it's almost irresistible. If you're informed that somebody has already flipped a coin 9 times and it's been heads every time, what's the probability it's going to be heads 10 times in a row? Well, surely you think it's going to be tails. He's already had this improbable run of 9 in a row. What's the probability the next one's going to be heads? Well, as Don says, 50%. It's a fair coin. It's not affected by what's gone before. But, Don, that's not what we're talking about here. This doesn't commit the gambler's fallacy. Because what we're asking here is, what is the probability of flipping a fair coin two times in a row and getting heads both times? Well, to get that joint event, two heads in a row, that's going to be 0.5 times 0.5 or 0.25. And so you got a 1/4 chance of flipping heads two times in a row. But what you're correct in saying is, if you've already flipped it once and it was heads, that doesn't reduce the probability of the next one.
Okay, if you're looking at statistical probabilities, to be correct in what you say, you have to be looking at future events. He's not looking at future events. He's looking at past events.
Yeah, okay? I don't see that is a germane consideration here, because he's asking, what is the probability of the joint occurrence of this series of events and or pieces of evidence, and whether it's past or future, I just don't see that that's relevant. I think that what will be relevant more is what Cindy said, and that is, what is the evidence base on which you calculate these? But I'll say something more about that later on. All right. Yes, our guest over here has a question.
Mine is more of an English definition problem. Surely the definition of a miracle, if they agree on the definition of a miracle, is that it can't be explained.
Is what?
Is that it can't be explained. That's why it's a miracle in scientific terms.
Well, now, that rules out supernatural explanations, right? I mean, you wouldn't want to do that. You want to say that the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances of Jesus can't be explained? I don't think you'd want to say that. You want to say they can't be naturally explained.
Right, right.
But they could be supernaturally explained.
Right, right. So why, if they're agreeing that it can't be scientifically explained, why are they trying to scientifically explain it?
Okay, they're not trying to scientifically explain it. People like Ehrman and Hume want to leave you in agnosticism about the resurrection. He doesn't offer some alternative explanation of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the Christian faith. He simply says that because of the very nature of the case, historical evidence could never make the most improbable thing the most probable thing. And therefore, you are left in agnosticism. And so that will leave you unable to affirm, at least on historical grounds, the resurrection hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead.
Okay, my second point was about the extraordinary events requiring extraordinary evidence. Well, if an event is extraordinary, then why are you trying to reduce it to the level of the ordinary?
They're not trying to. The Christian is offering a hypothesis to explain certain historical facts that is an extraordinary hypothesis. Something that is a miracle, something that has never been observed in the history of the world. And so the claim is, in order to believe something so extraordinary, you would have to have evidence for it that's equally miraculous. And therefore, you could never believe in the resurrection hypothesis. And what I want to show is why that slogan is demonstrably false. Yes. Okay? I have a little anecdote to tell you. I was in a class at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in my master's program in philosophy of religion, and it was dead midwinter in Chicago. It was freezing cold. There was a pond outside the classroom window that was frozen over with ice. You know how cold it gets in January in Chicago. And it was a David Hume class, and the professor, David Wolfe, was sitting at the front of the class, and he could look out the window and see the icy pond. But we students sitting further back could not see out the pond. And all of a sudden, as he was lecturing on Hume, he looked out the window and then he looked at us and he says, "There's a man coming up from under the ice." And we all rushed to the window, you know, to see. And in fact, it was some scuba diver that was repairing something under the water there. But I thought, what an interesting illustration of Hume's problem. Here was our professor, whom we trusted, who said there's this extraordinary event happening that we couldn't see. Now, suppose we couldn't rush to the window. Should we believe him or not? Hume's would suggest that, no, you shouldn't believe the evidence for such an extraordinary event. You should say your professor is lying or making it up or mistaken or something like that. But you wouldn't believe this extraordinary event that there's a man coming up from under the ice unless you had extraordinary testimony for it. And it just sort of illustrated, I thought, beautifully the whole problem that is raised by Hume's argument against miracles. Okay, some other comment or question. Bruce?
It goes back a while since I read that Hume miracles, yes. Years and years, but it seemed to me when we were discussing it, Hume speaks with forked tongue because he was anticipating criticism of his philosophy by saying you could apply the same ideas to anything scientific. There's
yes.
no guarantees that the same laws will apply as they did in the past. And he says, even though there's no guarantee, I'm going to take the stairs. I'm not going to walk out the third-story window. So in that, he's
yeah, there's a
the
very
same,
famous
same,
passage in yeah. Hume's essay where he gives the example, I think, of the Prince of Siam, who gets reports from travelers that he sent out that water can exist in the form of a solid. They've journeyed, you know, to the far north, and they've seen ice. And they come back to the man living in the tropics and says, water can exist as a solid. Now, this goes against all the evidence for the laws of nature that this man has ever seen. And therefore, applying Hume's principle, the Prince of Siam ought never to believe these travelers' eyewitness reports of ice that they've seen. And Hume admits this. He says, yes, that's right. He should not believe the evidence of these people because it contradicts the evidence of natural law that was available to him. So that ought to make one feel a little bit uncomfortable about this argument in that it's going to rule out not just supernatural events, but ordinary natural events. You could never discover anything new that went against what you thought were the laws of nature. Yes, right here. Here, let's get it in the mic.
Well, just as a fan of Sherlock Holmes, I just have to quote that when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Yeah, that's a very famous Conan Doyle quote, isn't it? Okay, any other question? Let's see, over here, yes.
Yeah, I guess the biggest problem I have with Hume's argument or arguments like that is it puts too much responsibility on the historian.
On the what?
On the historian or the person
yeah.
telling the story, because what it means is that as soon as you begin to talk about an event with which you're not familiar or the people with which you're not familiar, then you no longer trust anybody or you no longer believe anybody. And that seems like the job of a historian is to be able to get past that. I mean, you know, in your example of the guy coming up out of the water, it's an extraordinary event that a scuba diver is coming out of an icy pond, unless you know that there's an ROTC program and they practice that every single week. But, you know, they don't, to them, it's not extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, or to say that you lost a contact and some lady from across the room can see it, you know, from a mile away. Well, now we know it's, you know, it's possible. But, you know, if I go out and tell the story of the contact, that someone out in the hall is not going to believe me just because they're not familiar
yeah.
with the situation.
Yeah, a number of
people
have criticized Hume's approach by saying that the historian has to be open to the uniqueness of the past. And that to impose the grid of the present over the past is not to really be interested in doing genuine history. You have to be open to novelty, to the unexpected, and to follow the evidence where it may lead, which might lead you to revise some of your judgments that you previously had. But, yeah, these are all points that have been raised against Hume. Okay, Brad?
Just one follow-up question. Is the problem? Can you reverse the probability, and say, and this is back to my problem with the Bayesian dwindling probabilities.
Okay,
let's do it with the probability that it was not true. I mean, you do that oftentimes, and say it's going to be the probability that it was a resurrection is 1 minus the probability uh-huh. that the body was stolen, 1 minus the probability that, you know, all of the other, the guards took a bribe, and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think perhaps the response there would be that the skeptic isn't arguing for an alternative view, that these things did not happen. It's really an agnostic view, remember, that the skeptic is arguing for here. He's saying that you, Mr. Christian apologist, cannot bear the burden of proof to make the resurrection hypothesis the best explanation of the evidence, so that we are left in agnosticism. And people like Ehrman and Hume are quite happy to be left there. In fact, sometimes they'll say, you can believe in the resurrection by faith if you want to, ha ha ha, but you can't say that this is the best explanation or the most probable thing to believe. All right, what we'll do next time then, having laid these objections out, is explain why, in fact, David Hume's argument is regarded by contemporary philosophers as, to quote John Ehrman of the University of Pittsburgh, an abject failure. That is to say, a demonstrably fallacious argument. And I'll also show why I think planning as problem of dwindling probabilities is not an insuperable objection either.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.